Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Hey, welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. I have with me today a good friend, Conrad Weaver. Welcome to the podcast, Conrad.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for having me on the program. I'm excited to be here. And just a little shout out, we did a quick interview out in Las Vegas last week with you. So looking forward to posting
that.
That was fun. Technical snafus there early on, but we made it work. So,
man, it's the same everywhere. Sometimes things go great. Sometimes things go south, and that's just part of
life, right?
With technology. Yeah. Well, I'm going to do a quick little bio intro, but I want you to kind of, it's just going to be fodder for you. I really want you to expound on it, but Conrad Weaver is an Emmy award-winning producer, president, and owner of Conjo Studios, based out of Frederick, Maryland. And he is a documentary maker, which I did watch Heroin's Grip. That was an amazing documentary. But documentaries including Heroin's Grip, Thirsty Land, The Great American Wheat Harvest, which we found through conversation last week on your Great American Wheat Harvest, you went through my hometown.
Yes.
Which is a little pissant town in western Oklahoma. Nobody right. even knows where it's at. Yeah. And you were there.
I was there. We did some filming there. Yep.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, that's your official bio. What would you say about your bio to the listeners out here about what you do and what kind of drives you in this industry?
Yeah. Yeah. So I call myself a filmmaker, but I'm really in the heart of it. I'm an adventure seeker. Yep. And I find adventures through the stories that I find and through the stories that I tell. And lately I've been focusing, my efforts on the PTSD 911 film that you're familiar with. And I apologize for not sending you the screener. I need to get that to you so you can see the whole thing.
That's okay.
But I've become, for the past 5 years, I've been working, actually even longer than that. Heroin's Grip came out in 2018, but we started working on that in 2016. So really since mm-hmm. 2016, I've been kind of working in the mental health space and either on one side or the other, in the recovery community, right. on law enforcement or first responder community. And really right. in the past, since 2020 now, I've been working in the first responder community pretty much exclusively, whether it's through the PTSD 911 film or the first responder wellness podcast. And I love it. I found, we're all on a journey to discover purpose. And it was really a couple of years ago that I was really, I wouldn't say I was in a crisis, but I was in a place where I really had to evaluate who I am and what I'm doing. And in that process, I started working on this film and really discovered a new purpose. I think sometimes our purpose in life shifts and changes as we go through life, and mine certainly has done that. And my purpose now is to help first responders and first responder agencies live well.
Well, I love that. I share that philosophy that we're ever growing. And if you're not intentional about growing forward or growing in a positive nature, your growth will be at a negative nature. It just seems to be my experience in that. And before we get to the documentary, the reason you're here, I really kind of want to ask you about a couple of the other documentaries.
Sure.
The Wheat Harvest, and the that seems like such an adventurous documentary. Did you enjoy that?
Oh my goodness. That was, that film came about, and I got to give all credit to my wife. I was actually reading a blog about the Wheat Harvest, and years and years ago when I was young, I had a friend that went out west and joined the Harvest crew. He was, in his early 20s. Came back with stories of adventure and just seeing the Wild West and rattlesnakes, tornadoes and wheat and combines and all the stuff. And so that always been a thing that I knew existed. And for some reason in 2010, I started reading this blog from these people who do wheat harvest, and they travel and they live in their RV and they do all the things that harvesters do. And I was reading, and my wife looked over my shoulder and she said, "You should make a movie about that." And I said, great idea, honey. See ya. I'm off to make a movie. But you know what I did? I convinced the harvesting organization to give me some money because I said, I'm going to make a movie about your life. Well, actually, back before then, I called the harvester that I was reading her blog. I called her and we had a conversation. She was like, I've been waiting for 20 years for someone to tell our story. And then I convinced their organization. Oh, that's awesome. Convinced their organization to give me some money. And I borrowed my uncle's RV and I told my kids, we're going on an RV trip. And they were like, Dad, we've seen the movie. We know how this ends. You know, with Robin Williams and, you know,
wheat, the wheat gets cut.
Yeah. And then so we ended up in the wheat fields of South Dakota. And that was where we started making the movie. And I absolutely fell in love with these people. They accepted me. At first, they were like, I mean, you had one harvester that called me Spielberg. And they said, you know, you're this guy from Hollywood. I said, no. I said, I grew up on a farm. You know, excuse my French, but I've had shit on my butte, on my boots. Mm-hmm. And they're like, mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, so you get us.
You get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that was a really fun film and just still have friends from back then now. I mean, I can go to Nebraska and have a place to stay. You know, I can go to Kansas, have a place to stay. Oklahoma, over in what's that town in Western Oklahoma, right on the Texas border? Below the panhandle, has a bird name, I think. I forget.
Can't recall.
I don't remember. It's, anyway,
it's Kingfisher.
No, I forget. But anyway, it's a town. It's in Western Oklahoma. So harvester friends live there. I've been at their house. You know, it's just places, and just having these people that I know that are now connected to the earth or connected to. You know, providing food for the world. It's an important story. And that film did really well. Still is my number one seller on Amazon.
Love that.
And, you know, we were awarded a regional Emmy Award for that. It aired on some actually it aired on PBS in Oklahoma. And it aired on PBS in Iowa and some of the Midwest states and received a regional Emmy Award. So yeah, that's still my baby. And, you know, it's my firstborn, so I still have a love for that. So,
oh, for sure. Well, I think we mentioned it, but I'm going to qualify kind of because I want you to speak to a little bit to Thirsty Land. But last week, you and I were together at the EMS World Expo in Las Vegas, which spawned a little bit. And we did a podcast, but it spawned a little bit of a conversation about Lake Mead and maybe some of the fascinating pieces or areas that you got to explore. Thirsty Land. Give us a little bit.
You know, movies kind of tend to be joined together somehow, and Thirsty Land came out of the Great American Wheat Harvest, in that farmers that I was working with were always talking about the drought and the, you know, just the dry climate. And so as I was thinking about my next project, I thought, well, maybe I'll do a film about the drought in the American West. And my wife didn't buy it at first, and then I take her along to all the fun places. So I took her to Dodge City, mm-hmm. Kansas. so she
was happy about that.
Yes. And so it was July 14th of 2015, I think. And very dry. No, 2014. It was a drought in the area. And we were showing the Great American Wheat Harvest to this farm group, and all the farmers there were complaining about the drought. I mean, it was 100 degrees and windy and just dry. And my wife leaned over to me and she said, you better make that movie about the drought. And so I did some research and discovered that the one person that you had to have on a film about the drought, you know, water in the West, was this lady from Las Vegas called Pat Mulroy. She was the former head of Southern Nevada Water Authority. And I sent her an email, and a few weeks later got a response. Yes, I'd love to be in your film. We went out to Vegas, and that connected us then to the current Metropolitan Water Authority there in Vegas. And they said, hey, we're building this big pipeline to the lake, and we're drilling 600 feet down, doing a 3-mile tunnel underneath the lake, putting in the world's largest submersible pumps, and the tunnel's under construction. Would you like to go down there? And I'm an adventure seeker, and I said, of course I'd like to go down there. Well, we had took my little crew that was including my son and a camera guy I'd hired. We went over there and we got into this elevator, and literally I almost had a panic attack as we were going down into the ground underground, and I had to tell myself, it's going to be okay. They do this every day. It's going to be okay. They do this every day. Right. And we got to go down underneath the lake. After we came out, they told us, yeah, that tunnel, it's the highest pressure tunnel ever drilled anywhere on Earth. There's more pressure above it than any other tunnel because of the weight of the lake on top of it. And I was like, thanks for waiting till after we were out. I don't think I would have gone in if it would have been.
And holding that information was healthy.
But what they do now is they're able to pull water out of the lake no matter how low it gets. And right now, I think it's below 30% capacity. And so I was just out there last week looking at it, and it's like way low. It's just unbelievable. One of the marinas, they had to continually move it so it still floats, and it's pretty sad. So that film's available on Amazon as well. That one's kind of an academic film. We were in partnership with the University of Nebraska. They were a partner with that. And so, but it's a really informative film about, if you want to learn about water in the West, Thirsty Land is a great film to start.
That's awesome. Well, and I want to do a quick bit on Heroin's Grip, because I find that really fascinating before we dive into kind of why you're here, which is, I want to talk about PTSD 911 documentary, but Heroin's Grip, give us a quick little blurb on Heroin's Grip.
Yeah. So like I said, films are connected. Well, Heroin's Grip is connected in that the first two films took me away from home for weeks at a time. And so I was kind of ready to stay at home for a while. And the opioid crisis reared its ugly head in our community in the form of one of our local ladies. She's a socialite. She's kind of well known in the community. She put on Facebook that her son was incarcerated because of he was selling heroin out of her house, and big deal, right? And so I reached out to her and said, hey, Caressa, what's the deal with your son? And she said, oh, he's been using heroin. I didn't know all this stuff. And I was like, that sounds like a really fascinating story. And so we have partnered with her. She was an associate producer on the project, and we collected stories from right here in our home region of Maryland, which was kind of a microcosm of the greater problem around the country, the opioid crisis. At the time, we really focused just on heroin. It was really before fentanyl really became to be a big thing. It was just starting to show up early on. And we told the story of four people, two young people who lost their lives to overdose, and two who lives were deeply affected, but are still alive even today. They're still here, thank God. And we dive into their stories and kind of the impact that drug addiction has on families, on communities. And I was invited to do ride-alongs with local law enforcement. I got the ride with the sheriff's drug interdiction team. And they have a team of highly trained guys who monitor I-70 and have a canine unit. And I was with the number one guy that was credited for finding more dope on the highway than anyone else. And it was a really eye-opening, sitting there on I-70, cars flying by at 70, 80 miles an hour. And all of a sudden we were, head back in the headrest, and we were flying down the road, and he'd find a reason to turn on the lights and we would find dope. It was amazing. And he had all the little signals that these drivers would give us that they had drugs in the car. Right. And so would call the canine up, and the canine spotted on it. And then it was, the silver handcuffs, and off they went to jail. And so, but then, I was invited then to ride with the local police department. And one day, while I was not hoping for any overdoses, obviously, but if there was one, I wanted to be there. And one day we were called to an overdose, and lights and sirens, and off we went. And the scene, it was a fatal overdose. A young woman had just been in an argument with her mom that morning. Her mom told her, I hate you, I don't want to ever see you again. And now she's laying dead in the bathroom. And mom's downstairs screaming, chaotic scene. not anything that I was prepared for in any way. And the first responders, the police officer I was with, and the other first responders that were there were like, just Tuesday.
It's just another day.
Just another day. And that's what got me thinking about, okay, this is impactful for me. Why are you not as impacted by this? Or are you, and you're just not showing? And so I started doing some research on trauma and scenes of trauma in first responders and uncovered this whole issue of PTSD within the first responder community.
Well, I think this is a fantastic segue just to roll right into PTSD 911. Because you're teeing it up right here for us. Tell us about PTSD 911 and what drove you to really doing this.
Yeah. Well, it was really because of that day on that scene and the officer I was with that day. I asked her, I said, you know, do you guys suffer from PTSD? And she goes, oh, you only knew the half of it. And then she said, if you want to make a movie about that, I'll do anything I can to help you.
Wow.
And what she didn't realize that she'd become one of the main characters in the film. And so for the next 3 years, and this was like in 2017, 2018 when that event occurred. In 2019, I kind of said, okay, we're going to go all in. We're going to do this. And then of course, COVID hit. And in the meantime, we had screenings planned across the country for Heroin Script. Those all went away. But what that did is allowed, you know, so I was at home. So 2020 allowed me to really focus in on research and finding the stories that we wanted to tell. And so I partnered up with another producer that was local and she had wanted to work with me for a while. And so what we would do, we set up a webpage and had people submit stories. And then my other producer, she would vet those stories. She would set up Zoom calls and that's where we found Maddie, our firefighter out of Anaheim. Then I got a
shout out to Maddie Fiorenza, our friend Maddie. Absolutely. He's been on the show before.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's where we found. In fact, she had a Zoom call with Maddie and she called me later. She said, Conrad, I think I found our guy. He's willing to tell his story. It's very compelling. And so we built a relationship with Maddie. And then I had someone in the 911 community in Kansas called me. They had heard about the film project and I was looking for someone in 911. Well, back up before then, I was talking to our local fire, a president of our local fire company. And I sharing about the film and he said, well, have you thought about 911? I said, well, tell me about that. He said, I'm a dispatcher. We hear it. We imagine it in our brains and we don't get closure. It's a problem. And I said, oh, okay, that sounds like something I'd like to tell. And so when that word got on the street, someone in the 911 community, a leader in the 911 community from Kansas called me and she said, there's a young woman up in Boston that I think you need to talk to. And so my partner, Nancy, she called Nicole up in Boston and after a call with her was like, she is the one. And so we put Nicole forward in the film. And then our local police officer, Desiree, was local here, a friend of mine. I've been in Heroin's Grip. She appears in that film. So then we followed her in her journey, put those stories together. But I wanted to do more than just tell the stories of these three individuals. I wanted to bring some information that first responder agencies could use to inspire them to do better. To take care of their people. And so we found agencies that are doing amazing work, like Cal Fire. There is a police department in Garland, Texas that we worked with that is amazing chief. And which some of their work, you know, it's very different than the norm. You know, like the chief there in Texas, he said, we treat a brain injury, a mental health issue exactly the same as if you had a knee injury. And so if you have a knee injury, what do? You go get surgery, you go get a rehab, you take care of it until you're healthy, you come back to work. He said, that's what we do for a mental health injury. Oh, you have you need 30-day treatment, go get help, get better, go to rehab, come back, you have your job. Right. That's not the norm.
Well, I love that. I love putting into that perspective. And I, you know, and for the listeners, just to be clear, Conrad and I met each other early on in your journey. Yep. And it was before my life crisis. I talked pretty openly on this podcast about, and now reconnecting a little bit. It was really fun to reconnect last week and do your podcast and really catch up on a lot of things. But to personalize this, you know, that's exactly, you take a time out, you get healthy, you put everything back in order. And I'm very passionate about this stigma piece about, because there is such a stigma that it actually creates abnormally odd, if not, excuse me, abnormally odd, if not really damaging decisions surrounding these people who need our help. So all that, I kind of lead into on your website. I love to point out on your website, the goals for the film is raising awareness, ending stigma, and inspire systemic change. I love that. I love that about the film. Can you speak to those goals for your film a little bit?
Yeah. First, you know, raising awareness, obviously, you know, many of us are aware of that, of PTS, but I think the general public isn't. As a citizen,
right,
I didn't know these things. I didn't know first responders, you know, carry the weight of their calls on their shoulders. And so I wanted to bring that awareness to the general public and to not only just to the average Joe like me, but to our elected officials who are the bean counters, who provide resources for mental health, for services for their first responders. First responders are all across our country, and they take care of us. They take care of our community. They respond at 2:35 in the morning if I pick up the phone and call 911. And no matter where you are in the country, you can dial those magic three little numbers and someone's going to show up. You know, no matter what, they show up.
Right.
Right.
And every time.
So, I, as a citizen, I want healthy first responders because they're taking care of our community. And if we don't take care of our first responders, what's going to break? What's going to happen to our communities? Well, we've seen it. We've seen it on the evening news. I'm totally convinced that some of the big stories that we've seen over the past couple of years that have shown up on the evening news because of, you know, cops behaving badly or, you know, firefighters doing stupid stuff is a result of not being taken care of. You know, they let things go, and there's agency cultures that have not provided the help and the resources to help their members stay healthy. And so the awareness thing and the stigma thing comes in where, you know, and I know first responders are the helpers. Who needs, you know, why do I need help? I'm the helper. And so that culture of, you know, I had one old time firefighter told me, he said, in my day, it was suck it up. Here's a beer. Well, we can see where that led us, right? You know, alcoholism is high. You know, addiction is sky high. You have divorce rates are, you know, 75% and higher in the first responder community. You have the ACEs scores.
Right.
ACEs scores, a 7 average in the first responder community. You know, ACEs is that adverse childhood, you know,
right,
experiences. And so, we have these tough people who do tough work who don't want to admit they have a problem. Well, it's okay. And so the film, you know, we have Maddie. He's a firefighter, big guy, all tatted up, you know, been there, done that. He raised his hand and said, you know what? I have a problem. And if Maddie can do it with all the stuff that he went through, then I think that's a story that other people can emulate and say, you know what, if you can do it, I can raise my hand and ask for help. And then the whole systemic problem is, yeah, there's so many people. I had a guy tell me out in Las Vegas last week at the convention, he's a medic. He said that one of his first calls was a police involved shooting. A cop was down, a bad guy was down. He had to clean up the mess. No one checked in on him. And obviously that call still sticks because that's the first thing he brought up. They didn't have peer. They had peer support. He said, yeah, there was a number somewhere, but I didn't know who to call. We didn't have a debrief. That's a problem.
Right.
And my goal is through the film, through the podcast, is to help, you know, change the story there.
And really, you're normalizing a lot of this piece, which is in that space that you just described, that scenario that you just described, a thousand different questions. I've had this experience myself. You run through your brain, thousand different questions of, is this normal? Am I feeling it? Mm-hmm. Conrad over here is not experiencing what I'm experiencing. You know, he may be, but I don't know mm-hmm. that. And so it must be something wrong with me, or maybe I'm just not tough enough. I need to suck it up. And, mm-hmm. Or, you know, let's go have a drink. You know, the choir boys, you know, the choir mm-hmm. go have choir practice, mm-hmm. Along many of those signs. But I actually just, finished a podcast interview this morning that we were talking about this systemic issue of more administrative. And I think we were picking on administration pretty hard, but at the same time, there is a level of lack of knowledge. You know, I know that's not a good excuse, but at times, there's things they don't know either. So part of this, I think another great piece of this movie is that you're educating not just the public, but you may be educating a lot of our administration and leadership within our community of saying, hey, here's options, or here's what could happen if better decisions are not had. Is that fair?
That's absolutely. We had a screening. In fact, it's kind of a requirement to host a screening event. I tell people who want to host an event, especially a public event, bring the elected official. I want to see the mayors, the city managers. I want to see your local members of Congress. I want to see local state members of, you know, your state legislature. I want to see them in the room, because they are the ones that can say, hey, we need to put money in the budget to take care of these people. And recently we had an event in Salisbury, Maryland. We had the city manager there. We had chief of police. We had the fire chief. We had other elected officials in the room. And they are now doing things to help their first responders as a result of being in the room. And even that city manager was there. He came up to me afterwards, said, thank you for this. This is very helpful. It helps us move the needle in the right direction. And because it's been proven, if you have a city that cares for and provides resources for their first responders, it helps with retention. It helps with hiring. It helps with just the mental health for families. There's a fire captain in Little Elm, Texas. I had him on the podcast a few months ago. He said he went to his city leaders and said, I want a line item in the budget. I want to put a line in the budget for mental health for our fire department. How much? Well, it's this much. And I said, what percentage of the budget was it? Oh, he said it was like 0.00001 or something. You know, just very small mm-hmm. part of the budget.
Right.
They now have a waiting list of people wanting to work for them. They have improved, you know, improved performance on the job. They have fewer people calling in sick. They have, you know, the retention rate is very high. They have people coming from other departments that make more money coming to them to make less money because they know they're going to be supported. If you support your people and you take care of them and you provide the resources for them, it's not going to solve all the problems. You're still going to have some issues you got to deal with, but it makes a huge difference for that city and that community. And what is it less expensive to change your oil every 3,000 miles or to replace an engine every 5?
Right.
You know, every 5 years, because if you don't change your oil every 3,000 miles, you're going to be replacing your engine in about 3 or 4 years. And so,
well, and the cost of actually replacing a really good, stable work hand is enormous.
It's huge.
It's not just starting a new salary. It's time, experience, equipment. I mean, it is enormous.
All of the above.
You know, I learned something in Homeland Security. I was assigned to Homeland Security for a while, and I liken this to the mental health game. I remember a rule early on in infrastructure protection within Homeland Security back in the day was security is always the first budget line item to get cut. And what you're talking about is a philosophical belief of this is really important. Mm-hmm. And we won't move off of this, which is, you're talking about agencies who that becomes a pillar. They don't move on it. Most agencies take the adage of, you know, if we're short on budget, then let's cut it in the security area, which mental health would be in that mm-hmm. prevention. Mm-hmm. It's security and prevention, yep. Right? We're we're trying to prevent something from happening and we don't see the need for it. But I share your passion in this, that if you just dive in, all in, go in, all in on this, it will make a significant difference in your agency. It's just unbelievable.
You know, how much does a police department spend in buying ballistic vests for their officers?
Right.
I mean, I don't know how much one vest costs, a couple thousand dollars, I imagine.
Yes.
So why not spend, you're going to spend probably less than that per person putting together a budget, an annual budget for mental health services.
Yeah.
You know, for something that can change everything for an individual, for a department.
Sure. Well, I love the goals of the film. Let's talk a little bit about some details of the film. So I hear, you know, the passion in your voice when you start describing the film. Tell us a little bit about the players. Just give us a little snippet of these amazing human beings and their lives that you found. Maybe even some of them that are not in the film. I know you continually to meet a lot of these people out here just through connection to the film.
Yeah. So
tell us some of the great stories you have.
So in the film, we have a police officer as Desiree. She served her community for it's just a little over 20 years. And over the years has suffered from various things that happened to her in the course of her police work, including she got injured on the job several times, but once pretty significantly had a wrist injury where a perpetrator they were arresting fell on her wrist and smashed it. She had all the bones in her wrist were smashed. And so that has played a role in her challenges. But then she was let go partially because she was out of work for the wrist injury and she was suffering from PTSD. And we brought a psychologist in, a psychiatrist in, who hooked up this machine to her head and to a computer. And he said he has never seen such high PTSD scores in anyone. And so she was let go because of all that, because she was suffering through this and couldn't perform her duty. So the agency, instead of helping her, just kicked her to the curb. And which has happened thousands of times across the country, unfortunately. And so, you know, she's one that we're still working with, and we're still, helping her get to a better spot. So that was a challenge. She was afraid of losing her job. She's afraid of losing her pension, in which she did lose a portion of that. Then we have Maddie, the firefighter, who is a firefighter at Anaheim, California. He 20 some years on the job, firefighter, paramedic, had pretty significant childhood experiences that impacted his work. Ended up becoming a alcoholic, going down that road of drinking a lot, and then came into recovery up and down. And there was a moment in our production time, we spent about 3 years with each of these individuals over the course of 3 years. And he called me one day, and he had been in a great place, was helping others. He called me one day, said, "Conrad, you don't want me in your movie anymore." I said, "Why?" "Well, I picked up again." His drug of choice was alcohol. So that meant that he was back to drinking again. And so I've messed up. And I looked at him and said, "Maddie, that's exactly why I want you in the film." Because that's the story.
Right.
It's not a story of, we're not going to put a pretty ribbon on it and it's all fixed. As long as your heart's beating, there's a chance for failure, right? And as long as your heart's beating, there's a chance for hope. And so, we continued to work with him, and fortunately he came out of that, is in a better place now. But that was part of the journey of his journey. Then our final subject, our primary subject in the film, was Nicole Ford, who was a dispatcher, and she was out of Boston. She was one of the dispatchers on the Boston Marathon bombing event, which was significant for her. But even more significant was a police-involved shooting where a detective in her city was shot in the face by a perpetrator, and she arranged for him to get to the hospital, ended up getting a commissioner's commendation for her work in saving his life as a dispatcher. But that event triggered a series of events in her life, including a suicide attempt, and alcoholism, and just a lot of darkness. They ended up her leaving that agency, and but loved 911, continued to go back to 911 as a job. Then finally, as we were in production, ended up going to South Dakota, where she got COVID, and had some challenges there again. And so, full disclosure, Nicole was very well known in the 911 community. She was a rising star as a speaker, telling her story, helping others. Unfortunately, she couldn't help herself. And in August of last year, she took her own life. A real kick in the teeth for me. Sure. It still hurts really bad. But as we speak today, this is September, and I'm heading to Texas tomorrow, where her name will be inscribed on the Heroes Memorial Monument, along with a bunch of other people who've ended their life with suicide. And her story still matters. She's made a huge difference in the lives of many 911 people, and still is. And through the film now, is her story continues to be told. And as she, just a powerful message of that, no matter how good you think someone is doing, just reach out.
Right.
Just reach out and just talk to them. If they're happy and smiling, reach out. Just say, hey, just checking in on you. Don't give me the fine word. Don't give me the four-letter word. Fine. Just tell me the real deal. What's really going on. And if you're doing well, then tell me. If you're not, then tell me. And so.
Well, I certainly want to offer up, a heartfelt condolence to that loss. I didn't know Nicole. I knew about the her taking her life, but most of the listeners out here, if there are any listeners out here who have not lost a friend to suicide in this community, then count yourself lucky. I've had my share of losses to suicide, and I share that heartfelt connection with you in that, because it is very painful to see and experience the loss of a friend, a partner, in this community, and I'm so sorry for that. But having said that, what a great honor that they're doing in Texas to the entire community of people who have lost the battle to suicide, and honoring them on this brand new wall going up. And I thought I was going to make it down there. I'm leaving again for another trip, so I just didn't feel like I could squeeze it in. My heart will be there, but I'm not going to make it down there. But I do want to kind of circle back to, these people. And well, let me, a couple things here. I wrote some notes. One of the things is that you extended Maddie this grace of him calling and saying, hey, I've relapsed. I've fallen off. I've succumbed to the formidable foe of alcohol or PTSD once again. And Conrad, the grace you have to extend him this, hey, this is what we're talking about. Speak to that a little bit more. I mean, what a powerful message.
Well,
advocating your goals itself.
I think as a human being, and for me personally, I'm a believer, I'm a follower of Christ, and grace has been extended to me many, many times. I would be less of a human if I wouldn't extend grace to someone else. I've often said, in fact, I had a gentleman come up to me a couple of years ago, and it was like, yeah, it's too late for me. I go, man, your heart's beating. Your heart's
That's
beating,
right.
There's hope.
That's right.
And so I knew that while it would be challenging to continue to tell his story, because all of these subjects, I didn't know where they would end.
Right.
I didn't know we've had any of them left before the movie was over. That was a possibility. Right. And all three of them had a suicide attempt within our production time. So that was a very risk that I was taking. But if I wouldn't have allowed him to continue to tell his story, it wouldn't be a true film. It wouldn't really show what's really going on, because you know, we can butter things up and we can make it look pretty, but that's a false impression. That's a false narrative. You know, life is messy and it's okay to be messed up. It's not okay to stay there, but it's okay to, if when we mess up, let's reach back and help the next person up so that we can together make it to the finish line.
I think that is some of the real depth of this film, which is the realness of it. These aren't, you know, this isn't a Pollyanna documentary. This is a documentary of real life, real PTSD, real substance issues, real life hurdles that don't always end pleasant. I mean, obviously not with, but specific to, you know, Maddie, and to your point of, or to the point I'm making with this grace of just extending, you know, Maddie and I share a very similar story, and I have experienced both people offering grace and in this community, and people who have said, fuck you. I'm ashamed to know you. Don't want anything to do with you. And these were some of my closest friends. I mean, I lost friends over my life crisis and Maddie and I have had several conversations about this, and that's actually how we got so close, is sharing some of these challenges. And I find the people, excuse me, I find the people who extend that grace to be fascinating, and I have a love for them, as I do you in how you're narrating this, a love for them that is, it's hard to put into words. Like you, which I'm a believer as well, and I think that's the origin of a lot of this is look, we're called to love and extend grace because we're all imperfect. If you find a perfect one, let me know. But in the meantime, there seems to be within our community this level of, well, you can go this far, but if you go past that, then you're out, or we don't know you, or we disown you, or I think that's part of where the film tries to bring some realism, or you, Conrad, I haven't seen the film, but you, Conrad, bring some realism to this conversation of, hey, everybody's deserving of a second chance. Maybe they don't need to go back to work, or maybe they do. I don't know. But this is real life, and we're doing a courageous hero's job out here on the front lines. And shouldn't we afford them the opportunity to get and stay healthy?
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you at all?
Absolutely. And, you know, I often say that, you know, we're all on a continuum of life, and until our heart stops beating, we're not going to be perfect. We all have a chance of messing up. I have a chance of messing up. And we, you know, God gives grace to us. And, you know, my goal is to get better every day and to improve, you know, be 1% better tomorrow than I am today. And I think that is deserving of others. Now, there are some players in life that, you know, mess up and they say the big F you, and they don't care if they're hurting others. And they continue in that. And I sometimes have a hard time extending grace to them. But if someone's really genuinely saying, hey, you know what, I really messed up and I'm not doing well, I still need help, I'm going to extend grace to them. You know,
right.
I've had people in my life that I've had to say goodbye to that, you know, I really don't care to be your friend anymore because, you know, you give me the big F you, and you're not improving yourself. You're not working to make your life better. You're not making the people around you better. And so I'm going to cut off relationship, you know, and sometimes we have to do that for our own health and for our own mental health. We have to cut off those relationships, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when someone is genuinely saying, I need a hand, and yeah, I've messed up, yeah, I'm going to reach back and help.
No, I completely agree. There are people that just need to not be involved in your life if they're bringing discontent.
Absolutely,
it's a waste of your time. So kind of going back to the film, what was it, if anything, that really kind of surprised you when you started making this documentary, when you started in this room? Were there any aha moments that you're like, wow, I did not see that coming? Or
Yeah, I can't say that there was anything major, but what I did love seeing was the closeness that the first responder community has, the relationship they have with each other, that brotherhood. And I guess looking at it from the outside, you know, I never played like really serious organized sports. So I was never really part of a team that was, you know, tight and, you know, I mean, I played softball in college, but it was just the intramural thing. It wasn't anything that major. So I guess I'm looking at that kind of relationship and kind of like, I kind of wish I could have been a part of something like that. And I guess I experienced that a little bit when years ago, I worked in a psychiatric hospital for adolescents. I was part of the nursing staff there, and it was a tight group. You know, we were like family, and I kind of relate a little bit that way. But so I was really curious, you know, about that type of tight relationship that first responders have with each other. And I think that's it's a healthy thing, but it can also be an unhealthy thing if those relationships aren't healthy, if they aren't genuine with each other and really caring for each other in a way that is beneficial. Instead of just saying, here's a beer, suck it up, you know, there's a system that needs to be in place where we can be honest with each other.
Hard conversations.
Yeah. And that, you know, I saw that a little bit in a piece of the movie in the center. I have a kind of some shorter vignettes of little stories. And one of them is with a detective in Texas who, crusty old guy. He's become a friend now, and he did not want to be in the film. He was like, no. I mean, he cursed like a sailor and just you know, yeah, a man's man, you know.
I love the guy already.
On the bomb squad, and just, you know, he hadn't shaved in a couple of days, so he looked kind of rough. And we finally convinced him to sit in front of a camera, and he said, you know, he was involved in a police involved shooting where he took a man's life, and he said for 6 years he was in a very bad place. And he told me off camera that, you know, the last week before his chief said he needed to go get some help, he drank a whole case of whiskey, and it was that bad. But he went to his chief and he said, suppose there was someone messed up, you know, what would you do, you know? And the chief said, well, go get help. And he said, okay, I will. And his chief then told him, he said, I have someone for you that you need to talk to. Now the chief, he said, this guy said, he didn't tell me he was a therapist, because if he'd have told me I was going to therapy, I'd have given him the middle finger and said, you know, good riddance, you know.
Of course, yeah.
But he had some other words that he used and he said, and it saved my life. You know, and here was a chief that saw that this man needed help, didn't kick him to the curb because he was afraid he was going to be a liability to the department. No, he was a valuable part of their team. Let's get him some help. And now he's back. I think he's actually retiring in a couple, like this year or something. But he told me, this is an interesting part of the story. He told me at the premiere, that we had the premiere in Irving, Texas, and he came up to the premiere and had his girlfriend there. And he shook my hand. And he said, thank you for letting me tell my story. Because now every time I tell my story, I heal a little bit more. And I was told, just last year, I was told by one of his coworkers that he was so proud of being in the film. And he just has, you know, 2-3 minutes in the film total, that he bought one of our posters, our movie posters, got it framed, got it hanging on his wall, you know, and he's so proud of that. And it was an honor to have him in the film and for him, because there was a lot of people who were watching who could relate to him.
Sure.
You know. And he was like, yeah, I didn't believe in PTSD. P stood for something else, you know? And so it was just that kind of a guy, you know? And now he's like, yeah, I was messed up. I needed help and I got the help I needed.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
This film, let's make it a little more personal to you. Mm-hmm. This film, how has this journey of the last few years of working in this community and seeing You know, a lot of hurting folks. You're specifically talking, intentionally talking to people who are hurting. How has this impacted you, for good or bad or both?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something I talk to my therapist about. Yep, I see a therapist. And
good for you.
It, I have to say this, I was kind of resistant. I'm okay. I'm good. But my good friend Todd from Garland PD, he's the wellness officer for Garland PD, the same department that I just talked about. He kept bugging me, kept poking me. When are you going to therapy? When are you going to therapy? You need to, you got vicarious trauma. And so it was a couple months ago, he sent me an email, and this is Todd for you. He sent me a list of all the culturally competent therapists in Maryland. And he said, pick one.
So this is not a hint.
This is not a hint. I said, you're going to do this. Sir, I'm going to do this. And I love it. I have a therapist who is a former cop. He's a former detective with Baltimore County. And he's been there, done that. And we just have a great time getting together and talking. And it's been really helpful for me. Part of what I'm working through right now, just, and I'm going to be talking to my therapist about this, so full disclosure here, this is kind of opening up the chest.
Sure.
Is I'm an empath, which means I feel deeply. And so when I have someone in my life, like some of the subjects in my film who are still struggling, I'm not sure exactly always where to draw the line, where I cannot care anymore, you know? And so I need to talk about that. I need to talk about how far do I go? You know, sometimes I'm worried if I don't get a text back from them, you know, okay, are they okay? Do I need to go check on them? Do I need to drive to their place and check on them? You know, so I'm having to work through that as someone who cares deeply. And so that's what I'm gonna be talking to my therapist about next time I see him. So yeah, these things affect me, and but I'm thankful for what I'm doing, and the results outweigh the stress and the challenges of and the pressure of dealing with folks like this. We had a screening in Mississippi a couple months ago, and a fire chief comes up to me afterwards, kind of a big guy, his arms full, like, yeah, I didn't think I had a problem until I saw your movie. And the more the more I talk to him, the more I realize that he's not doing so well. And the great thing is, he was willing to talk about it. And because he said, we have never talked about this thing. He said, I've only ever been involved in two critical incident debriefs, two in a whole career. So we don't talk about these things here. Today, I was able to then connect him to a retired firefighter out of California, and who had started a support group, and he was giving him some tips and helped him start a support group in Mississippi. And now he's also bringing people in to train his people in the areas of mental health and wellness, all because he went and saw the movie.
I love that.
And that's just
I love that.
You know, job well done. And it's stories like that that keep me going. Stories like that I know people's lives will be changed and better because they spent an hour and a half and watched a movie. And that's what keeps me going every day.
Do you find that you see life a little bit different having peeked on this side of the behind the curtain of the first responder world?
Yeah, for sure. Because now, so I live in a small town in Maryland. We have a volunteer fire department. And so they still blow the siren. You know, I wake up at 2 a.m. and the siren's going off, and I have the app on here, the scanner app. And my first thought isn't now, okay, who's hurting, what emergency is. My first thought is, how are those first responders doing? You know, so
I love that.
I hear of a bad accident on the freeway and there's fatality. My first thought is, I hope to have peer support. You know, I hope to have someone, I hope those medics and those police officers and those responders have someone to talk to. You know, there was a horrific murder here in community a few years ago, and I talked to the sheriff, this is now maybe 8 years ago, and he said it was one of the most horrific scenes he's ever saw. And, you know, things like that, I now think, okay, do they have peer support? Do they have people to talk to? Are they willing to talk about things? Right. And so I see these stories from a different angle now than I did before. So I think that's a good thing.
I think it's an important point to make here. It's been my experience and in my education that not all horrific calls for our listeners out here mean that they're going to impact you to a PTSD
right.
Level or a PTS level. However, all of them can.
Yeah.
Just depending on you know, your connection with it, and there's a lot of reasons behind it. And if you want to know more, you can reach out to me. But I think it's important to note that you know, a lot of this is cumulative. There's some acute, like that one would be very acute, but there's some things here for, you know, for mine's cumulative, and it's a whole lot. There's several that are acute, but I really am thankful for you, Conrad, in taking this adventure on, this story telling adventure on, and really highlighting some of these people. And I really appreciate the realness of it, that you're not backing down from or scaling, maybe is a better word, scaling this back to a generic Pollyanna theme of, but you're leaving it out there unadulterated. Here's the real story. And I'm so grateful for that. If somebody, kind of wrapping up here as we kind of close out, if somebody wants to learn more about the film, or maybe even bring their film to their community, how do they get a hold of you? How do they find it? How do they get a screening in their hometown?
Sure. The best way is to come to the website, PTSD911movie.com, all one word, PTSD911movie.com. And there's a link there that says click for screenings, and there's a form there you can fill out. And we make it easy. And I've had people tell me I'm not charging nearly enough, but we do a flat rate. I'll just say it is $2,500. You can bring, I'll come. That includes my travel time, unless, you know, it's Australia or someplace like that. I'll come to your city. We'll show the film and we'll have a conversation around that. And it's also available for purchase for agencies. So an agency can purchase the film. We, in fact, just today had the Park Service, the Washington, D.C. National Park Service Police purchased the film to use it for training within their agency. And so we have agencies like that. We have large and small agencies purchasing the film. There's a scale. There's a sliding scale for that. It starts at $350 for an agency of up to 100 people. And you get the film, you get a second film called Risk Lock from my buddy Jason Harney. Then you have, there's about 7 or 8 other videos there that are available that we call the toolkit that are used for training. There's resources from the 911 Training Institute, from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. There's resources from the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation and some others. And so all that's included in the toolkit for one price. And so all that information is available on the website. And that's the easiest place to go. We're also on all the socials, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, at PTSD911. And follow us on all those places. And I'm now, for better or for worse, I'm on TikTok as well. So which is kind of weird.
Conrad's a TikToker. Well, I don't want to leave the conversation without giving you props on riding your bike across the U.S. Give us a 30-second blurb on that experience. Wow.
Yeah. So as the film was finished and I had been thinking about doing a coast-to-coast bike ride for years, and I thought, what a better way to promote the movie than to ride a bicycle from Oregon to Maryland? There's first responders in every community that we ride through. There's even firehouses that we could probably sleep at. And so my buddy John, who retired from the government job, I said, John, do you want to go on a bike ride? And he said, sure, where are we going? And I said, well, we're going Oregon to Maryland. And he goes, oh, okay. And so we did. May of last year, 2023, May 15th, we left Astoria, Oregon on the Pacific Coast, then rode 65 days across the country all the way to Ocean City, Maryland. And we stopped at about 14 cities along the way to show the film. And we stayed in some firehouses. We had amazing meals with firefighters and met with police officers and just met with first responders all across the country. It was an amazing journey for my own mental health. And I'm actually in the process of writing a book about it. And so hopefully that'll come out sometime next year. A personal development book on what I learned about myself, what I've learned about life riding a bicycle across the country. So there are some videos on YouTube. You can search Coast to Coast 23 and you can look up those videos and you can see some of our adventures that we went on that ride. So it was a great time.
I love that. And it was fun watching you on social media get across there. So Conrad, my friend, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a treat. And more importantly, thank you so much for what you're doing in this community of advocating for change in people's mental health. These first responders, these heroic, courageous individuals need people like you advocating. So thank you so much for it.
Absolutely. Appreciate it's my you. Pleasure. And thank you for having on the program. I really appreciate it.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.